Let me tell you guys that I am so excited. Yeah, I am so
interesting.
Happy.
Yeah, you came across many points, and I definitely would say, I think there's this great debate. I think there's this, like, is the inflation transitory? Is it mostly supply driven? Because, like, there, like, at least the Fed is arguing with regards to, let's say, lumber, or I think you said used cars. That with that, like, we had the case of, like, low interest rates, low mortgage rates. So many people went to buy homes, build homes. The demand spiked up high, and then people, due to COVID, the supply was lower. So the lumber spiked, and the same thing, similar thing with these chips, right? The right. chips that the car needs. And so used cars became more available. Were the only thing that was available because Ford was closing their factories and whatnot. So it's a weird thing where we have these spikes, and it's funny that we're seeing them, like, in different areas, and you can't really predict where it happens, but it happens. But then I think that also the debate, that from what I understand, is that where inflation really becomes a problem is if wages were to rise. And you get inflation in wages where people get more income, they spend more, and then naturally prices keep going up.
Yeah, I mean, I think wage growth is not necessarily a bad thing. Mm-hmm. I think the Amazon worker in the warehouse, or, you know, someone at McDonald's, if they're going from $12 an hour to $18 an hour, or anything moving up the chain, where, you know, an entry level worker at a bank goes from $50,000 to $60,000. There's a good story to tell there, and that's something that's a positive for most of society. It helps to lift people up and give them more income to spend. And then ultimately, I think that's better for the economy. But you're right. If demand all of a sudden outpaces that natural wage growth, then you sow the seeds for inflation, and then that wage growth becomes less meaningful to those people because they're only able to buy a little bit more as opposed to a lot more than they were with that wage growth. All this goes back to, you know, I think we were talking about, you know, what's the biggest risk? And I'm like, I don't know. That interconnectivity is the part that's tricky. You go back to the chips and the used car component, the used cars became popular because new cars were held up by the supply chain, which was held up because microchips were held up via, you know, with COVID closures and things like mm-hmm. that. There's so many examples like that where the supply chain has been disrupted, and now it is starting to come back online. That, to me, that is a good argument to me that this inflation that we're feeling right now is transitory, because as things come back online and people get more integrated into the system, get back into the natural order of things, then that's sort of getting back to normal, or whatever a post-COVID normal is going to look like. My counter argument to my argument, which I just had there, is that when you have $4 trillion of infrastructure spending on top of loose credit, or I should say low cost credit, in addition to the world coming back into form, suddenly then you are getting that sort of huge supply side support. And by supply side, I mean spending. And if demand comes roaring back, that could be a situation that I think might be difficult for the central bank planners to modulate. Now, again, the counter argument to the counter argument would be, if things start to overheat, that's when they will raise rates and they'll make credit a little less easy to hit. All of which is to say, you know, who knows? I do worry a little bit that the Fed's ability to deal with the interest rate barometer has become pretty politicized, such that if the market starts to get spooked or the bond market gets quaky, have they lost the will to actually govern via fiscal and monetary policy? I think the answer right now is no, they haven't lost the will. It's just, I hope it doesn't uncouple from sort of those natural economic animal forces that are out there and they don't have as many tools in their toolkit.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I guess my point of view on the Fed, like if we were to go back, I think that they've when the COVID hit, I think they had two options. You could go with the depression, which is probably like a 10 year period of just like deflation, no growth. We know what depression did in the 30s was terrible. Or they had do what you did before, do fiscal stimulus. Now the government has a lot of power in terms of where the money goes. Do whatever you can, the monetary stimulus, and then worry about the inflation later, because you cannot go with interest rate lever. You cannot go to -1 interest rate. I mean, at least as a Fed, interest rate can go negative. We saw that in Europe. But like, if you get an inflation, they can always raise rates, and then they can use that lever to slow down the speed. So I kind of understand why they went into why they chose one of the two evils, even if probably, for sure, in one of their models or something like that, raising interest rate in such an environment will probably cause a recession. But in the end, a recession is still better than depression.
I agree with you on that. I think, you know, if I look back at the last year and a half, and if I'm really honest with myself, I'd say, you know, we had a lot of moving parts. It was, you know, shut down the economy. You're looking at, you know, 1 million people dead or more. You don't know what the virus is or isn't. You don't know if the vaccines are going to work.
And you made money on Robinhood. made money on Robinhood. You know, it's like.
Yeah, but even more than that, I think the general notion that the governments, as inept as they were in many different respects, I think they had their hand at the wheel pretty well in terms of guiding the world economy out without completely cratering it. And it was a real risk and made very apparent. You know, as we're sort of fumbling around trying to figure out what to do on vaccines and so on, the adoption of the vaccines really should go down as one of the real hallmarks of human achievement with the mm-hmm. speed at which it's happened. Now, obviously, the variants have come up, but we knew that there were going to be mutations in this. But to get things back up and running pretty well, obviously with a lot of casualties and a lot of collateral, but to get things up and running, I mean, this could have been so much worse. And I think we're doing okay. Obviously, mm-hmm. there's plenty of counterexamples of where people have screwed up. You know, we look at low vaccine rates in some of the states here in the U.S., and that's a disappointment and mm-hmm. and could be a problem going forward. But all in all, I think we're, economically speaking anyway, I think we're pulling out of it decently. And, you know, whether it was by design and a little bit of luck and maybe just shoehorning onto some really good technological achievement with the vaccines, I think we got grazed by a bullet, to be sure, but I think we ultimately got it to dodge a lot of important parts.
Yeah, I completely agree. And especially if you know people outside of the United States in different countries, if you speak to people, there are still countries that are on full lockdown.
Sure.
There are countries that businesses slow down significantly, where you're still recording negative GDP. It's still having effect. It hasn't passed. It's going to have a long impact on the economies. I mean, it's going to have a long impact here as well, but here we came back quicker. And one thing I want to ask you, it seems with regards to go back to the inflation, it seems that one thing that everybody in the market are a little bit confused about is why is still the Fed doing their asset purchases and whatnot? Why are they still stimulating the economy? And I was thinking of, let's assume that people in the Fed are a little bit, they for sure have a better information availability than me, you, or Mark, or John, who are in the markets. Right. And they are probably a chairman of the Fed or in that group of people. They're smart. They're probably educated. They have more information. So I would say, I was thinking there are two ways why, at least in my mind, two reasons why the Fed would communicate that the inflation is transitory. One is because inflation is if you claim that inflation is transitory and you convince everybody that it's transitory, it actually will be transitory because as you said, in the financial markets, we experienced asset inflation and people are like, I'm going to miss out. I'm going to miss out. If we start feeling the same thing in the economy is that, oh yeah, I'm going to, this, the prices are going so high that I have to buy something now. You, in general, you create inflation just by that action.
Right.
And then on the other hand, there's a scenario where, and I'm also looking at the bond market and low interest rates where you can't, where many people can't really explain them, is that, are we underestimating the risk of COVID still, where they are not sure yet that we are out of this, and then the probability of getting another variant like this Delta variant is underestimated in the equity markets, but the bond markets are actually pricing it in, and you're having these very, very low yields, even though you're getting like 5% CPI and inflation numbers. Do you have any opinion with regards to that, the Fed communicating to people and what that?
I agree with you that the Fed is trying to manifest an approach that doesn't incite panic by using the I word. There's still people, you know, old enough who, when they heard inflation, that immediately sends them visually to gas lines. And in the early 80s, when interest rates were, deposit rates were 12% and interest rates were 14%, and the home ownership was a lot different back then. And so the Fed and the other market movers, I think, are quick to try to create a middle of the road approach. We assume that the data supports that. I'm not smart enough or have enough access to the data to really confirm it. But you know, I don't mind the government sort of taking that tact and trying to ease things back in. As far as the COVID and the overall component of it, I've been vaccinated just for a few months now. And I would say, personally speaking, I felt like New York and I were probably starting to get used to not having the masks and really getting back to normal. That shifted as recently as this week for me. And I have just, and I guess the story that really hit home for me was all the hubbub around Tokyo and the Olympics, and you know, they may shut them down. They're not going to have spectators. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, okay. You know, I sort of knew that the world outside the U.S. was having more trouble, but Japan, a very developed nation, is really having trouble with it, and they're not. You know, that's a big gesture when they're thinking about canceling the Olympics for a second time. So I think, the meeting out of that information from governmental sources is definitely something to watch. I try not to put my tinfoil hat on too much and question everything, but I can imagine that the Fed is hearing things saying, you know, let's not go full speed ahead. We're not out of the woods yet. This is our first, let's call it, relapse that we have to deal with. And, you know, we may have to message out to the population, half of whom probably doesn't have a lot of trust in the government right now, that you're going to need another vaccination or a booster shot or something like that. And so that's something that I think, if there really are long-term planners within government, that's something that's going on too. I would add one other thing, which I don't know how much it concerns me so much, but it's something that I question myself, is there are a lot of people in this country, in New York especially, who haven't paid rent, either their business or maybe themselves, for a year and a half. And those forbearance situations are going to start coming offline at some point. Unemployment is going to be tapered off, and the ability to not pay your mortgage or not pay your rent and not get kicked out of your apartment is going to slowly go away. And I don't know how much of that has been priced in. And so I think that's one other component that I don't hear much about, and I may be undereducated. There are probably some real estate people. I talked to one guy in particular who said, yeah, I've had no problems. Everyone's paid on time. And I was stunned when I heard that. Mm-hmm. But other people who don't have that ability, or some landlords or some building owners who are on rickety-er ground financially than they may be used to, or certainly have lower cash positions, And that's something I'm not convinced is built into the equity markets or sort of thinking generally. And that's the type of data point that I hope the Fed maybe does have their handle on, that maybe the public isn't on top of. And that might be arguing for why they are keeping rates a little bit low. They're not being as aggressive in terms of, let's call it, normalization. That might be a data point that's out there, because let's take it, let's sort of think through it for a second. So let's say, you know, you have, and I'm going to stick with New York only because I'm here and it's top of mind, but let's say all of a sudden half of your tenants up and bail or haven't paid you, and or you're getting in 50% of the income you're normally used to seeing. Those taxes aren't going to walk away and not need to be paid. The maintenance on the building is still going to be need to be paid. The employees of the building, et cetera. It's up to the landlord to deal with that. Now, let's say it got strong enough, or that the economies of scale were bad, or that the landlord, you know, the building owner was over levered and couldn't make the mortgage payments on top of that. I could envision that type of thing flowing up into the balance sheets of banks and underperforming loans and things like that. Now, I haven't really seen or heard any particular evidence of that, but I think a lot of that is due to the fact that there are lots of legal things in place, forbearance laws and so on. You can't get kicked out of your apartment, and you're allowed to not pay your mortgage for a little while, you don't have to pay your rent, et cetera. When those things start to unwind and stop becoming the standard day-to-day way of doing things, then we might start to see those up the river impacts that I just described. And that might be something that the Fed is looking at and saying, okay, as we gently go from COVID to normal, whatever normal turns out to be, that is going to be something that is going to be tough for the public, the investing public especially, to swallow under normal characteristics. And that's something I look out for from a data point. Just say, you know, I don't hear much about it. I don't hear much about underperforming loans. Everything seems hunky-dory, and everybody seems to be flush with cash, and they're paying and all that stuff. Like, maybe that's something we aren't seeing yet on the surface, that may be below the surface.
Yeah, interesting point. My assumption there was that people would use their government checks to pay the rent. But it's a fair point. And one other thing I would point out as well, at the same time, I've been working from home since the pandemic started, and I can imagine how many people in New York work from home. That as well certainly has had an impact on people who own like real estate and rented to corporations and all that stuff, because a lot of them left, and especially in New York, right, when you had so many office space and so many buildings. I think the real estate market, and I'm definitely not an expert in real estate market, but I'm not even I don't know too much about the real estate market, but my feeling is that the real estate market probably now is in a very uncertain spot, where you have these potential long-term trend of a hybrid work environment where, hey, Fraser, you can work from home, but you can also come into the office, no worries. And that's going to many people, and many people are choosing to stay home. I know that my company, for example, they have no problems with people working from home, because we have really, we've been performing very similarly, if not better, from home. And then at the same time is what you mentioned, and the very high, the prices of homes that are cooking due to the super high demand and interest and low interest rates and mortgage rates. So it's a very, I don't understand it fully, but I understand it enough to understand that there are many moving parts that make it very risky at this stage. I know what you think.
Yeah, well, again, New York, and I think this applies to a lot of other cities, but the way I analogize it is that, you know, for most people who work in New York, they are commuting in from Fairfield, Westchester, New Jersey, Long Island. And the days of people putting on their trench coats and waiting to take the hour train to come in 5 days a week when they don't have to, I think are going to be substantially over. I think that, as you said, there's going to be a hybrid model where people are expected to be in the office anywhere from 3 days a week, maybe four, something like that. But there's going to be some sort of accommodation for people to work from home. There's been precedent that it generally works, et cetera. For that class of people, let's say lawyers, accountants, asset owners, people in control of their career, that type of thing, who don't have to be in the office, let's say, or aren't in a pooled environment. Yeah, suddenly you need 60 to 80% of the real estate that you needed before. That's significant. And that ultimately causes people to rent less real estate. It causes people to downsize or move to different parts. I think where people locate is going to be interesting. So sort of that class B or class C office space that's just off the beaten path, you're going to see a lot of smaller businesses say, is this really worth it? Or can I rent a conference room when I need it and come in and all that? I mean, that's a difficult part. The next stage is, you know, there's a lot of commentary about JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley telling employees, yeah, you got to be in. We don't care what happens. And there's good reasons for that, especially when you've got younger people that you have to try to sort of drive a culture around and have the collaboration and the back and forth that just doesn't really exist over a Zoom call. That won't go away. And that's in the financial services world. You know, then it gets back to tech. I mean, you look at the Facebook and Twitters and Googles. I think they've made major investments in real estate in New York, and I think they'll continue to be here and use it. And I think it's a way to attract talent. But ultimately, that talent is going to say, look, you know, I'll come into the office once in a while, but I can do my coding or whatever from my laptop at a Starbucks or back in my apartment or not even in New York. And that's a scary thing. I think the other trend that's a little worrisome, and you know, for those people who are in it, I mean, the people who are starting out and kind of in the Zoom world, I don't know how they're going to deal with things, because the development takes place when you're with your boss and you're with your colleagues. You can't replicate that online. I think the one thing that's a little scary for the online, or for the, let's call it middle management up to upper middle management, is I think it's the concept of you're not only, now that it's work from home and that where you work is less important, you are now not only competing against the people in your geography, you're now competing against the world, or certainly the United States, and by extension, the world. And so if you're living and costing a company New York prices versus Nashville or Bozeman or wherever, and the job can get equally, or let's even say 90% done at 60% of the price, larger companies are going to make that leap and say, you know what, we don't need this type of expense. And that's something that I think will, it's going to take a while to bore down, but you're already starting to see it. I think that a lot of places are moving certain functions. They've already been moving certain functions from high cost areas to low cost areas. That's not new. But I think COVID has accelerated that, because the requirement that everything has to happen within a certain geography is diminished, not eliminated, but reduced. And so that brings in that cost factor, I think, is going to be top of mind in a year or two, once we're further away from the COVID experience.